From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. United Airlines shares were down 3% in early trading today as investors start to take stock of just how damaging that video was to the company's image. A passenger forcibly removed from a United flight on Sunday by being pulled from his seat and dragged down the aisle by police. United says it offered passengers hundreds of dollars to take a later flight because the flight was oversold. And then when airline employees were unable to get volunteers, they had to select passengers and remove them from the flight. Today, Congressional Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton is calling for a congressional hearing on what happened. United CEO Oscar Munoz said in a letter yesterday that he regrets what happened, but he said the passenger was disruptive and belligerent and his employees followed proper protocol. The Chicago aviation security officer who dragged the man off the plane has been placed on leave. Seth Kaplan is managing partner at Airline Weekly. He joins us now. Seth, welcome back.
Good to be here, Jeremy.
And so much has happened in this story in the last 24 hours. What do you make of how United has handled this?
Well, they don't seem to think that they really did anything wrong here. I mean, they expressed regret for what happened, but they're still placing a fair amount of the blame on the passenger. And, you know, I think this is one of these things where even though you can look at the individual elements of what happened and say that, you know, in a vacuum, some of the things made sense. I mean, involuntary denied boardings are a fact, a rare fact, but they happen every day for valid reasons. But it's just not all that often that you have somebody who, you know, did absolutely nothing wrong and is already boarded, already sitting in his seat, and then just kind of extracted like that. Usually, those few involuntary denied boardings that do happen when they can't get enough volunteers, as they usually can, happen out in the gate area. So it just kind of feels a lot more like, you know, your flight was canceled than what this guy went through.
Well, and Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, who joins us on this show very frequently, said in his piece about this, the footage is shocking. So is the law, which, as you point out, this is something that they are legally allowed to do.
Yeah, and the sort of the involuntary denied boarding regime, if you will, or involves, it's kind of this nasty side effect of a system that usually works, I'd say, pretty well for airlines and their customers. You know, it all goes back to the oversales, which there are some consumer benefits to that. When airlines can sell more seats, I mean, it's supply and demand economics. Airfares are lower than they would be if they had to always fly with a few empty seats. And usually people who get bumped are really happy about it because usually they're volunteers who get to take their family sometimes on a free trip next time. I mean, look, one time I got to where I was going literally before I was supposed to get there because they reaccommodated me onto a nonstop flight when I volunteered. I was happy. Most people are happy. But this does happen. If you're going to have oversales and you're going to have volunteers, there has to be a way to deal with people when there just aren't enough volunteers. But it should never come down to this. There had to be some other way. You know, the reports where they were offering up to $800, they said $1,000. Offer more. I mean, at that right. point, it would have been worth it to avoid what they're dealing with right now.
Is it a coincidence that this is United? Because I do notice when I fly, and occasionally I'll fly United, they're always overbooked more than any other airline that I've been on. I mean, do they do this more than the other airlines or what?
Well, some airlines in the world don't overbook. The major example in the U.S. is JetBlue. It doesn't overbook flights. The others all do to varying degrees. A lot of them do less now than they used to. And in fact, there were fewer involves in the last full year for the statistics was 2015 than in the past. United is, last I looked, yeah, somewhere in the middle of the pack. I mean, they have them. United, American, and Delta as airlines that carry a lot of corporate travelers just tend to have flights that are oversold more. It's just the nature of it. You know, leisure flights where, you know, people are going to Disney World, generally those travelers always turn up. A Tuesday morning flight from Chicago to Dallas with business travelers, you know, people whose meetings run late or end early and they switch flights, you just tend to have more no-shows. And so those airlines tend to have more oversales. Despite it all, very few involves, but and in a situation like this, I mean, I've certainly never seen it. I, like you, have been on a lot of flights. You just have to take care of it before it gets into that situation.
So what does United have to do now? I mean, are we going to need to hear from the CEO of United at a press conference to explain this, or what do they have to do?
Well, yeah, I would have liked to have heard United just really recognize that what this guy went through was unacceptable. It's fine to explain why involuntary denied boardings exist. You know, there's a legitimate reason for it. And I think if customers, you know, could really understand the whole system, I think most would agree that, yeah, you know what, on balance, because it's so rare that this happens and there are some other benefits to it. Yeah, I'm fine with that in terms of the system, but I think they need to make that distinction between, yeah, we believe in involuntary denied boardings when they have to happen as a part of this system that generally works, but we don't believe in what happened to this person on this flight. And I don't think we've quite heard that from United. They're still blaming him somewhat. And yeah, he didn't comply with you know, crew member instructions. And we all know, we've heard this safety demonstration about, you know, the importance of doing that. But in this case, you really got a feel for that guy. And I'd like to hear the airline expressing that.
That's Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today, voters in South Central Kansas will be the first in the country to decide a congressional race in the age of Trump. Now, the winner of a special election in the state's 4th congressional district will replace Mike Pompeo, who left Congress when President Trump asked him to head up the CIA. Under normal circumstances, the 4th congressional district in Kansas is considered a lock for the Republican candidate. But as Frank Morris from Here and Now contributor KCUR reports, these are not normal times.
Kansas Democrats are coming off wins last election, and especially compared to Democrats in the rest of the country, they're pretty pumped. As you could see a couple of months ago when Bernie Sanders showed up in Topeka.
How many of you are feeling the burn tonight?
Many Kansas Democrats are also stoked about the new guy.
Well, everybody, my name's James Thompson. I'm running for Congress down in the 4th District.
Thompson is a Sanders man, a political newbie who managed to beat a well-known Democrat to become the party's candidate in the 4th. He's a civil rights attorney and strongly pro-union. He grew up dirt poor, mainly in Oklahoma, and served in the Army, a fact he promotes in his advertisements, where he's seen shooting a military-style rifle, wearing a cap with a fake bullet.
Americans. I want to be your congressman. I want to fight for your jobs. I want to fight for our veterans. And I want to fight for your personal freedoms.
My name's James Thompson. I'm a Kansas veteran, and I approve this message.
Thompson says he has lots of grassroots support, and he's been able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, reportedly with help from a Sanders email list. But Thompson is running in Wichita, home of Charles Koch, Koch Industries, and the Kansas Chamber of Commerce. So it's not surprising that Thompson faces an established Republican.
Well, Ron Estes is the Kansas State Treasurer, and he's not a very well-known person, and you know, nothing against him, but not an overly dynamic politician.
Bob Beatty, a Washburn political science professor, says Estes is a familiar face around Wichita, where he served as Sedgwick County Treasurer. Estes has worked as a manager in the oil and manufacturing businesses. He stands out among Kansas Republicans as an early and avid Trump supporter. Like Trump, Estes promises to cut regulations and bring back manufacturing jobs. In one ad, he stands in an algae-covered pond, repeating another Trump pledge.
I will never compromise our conservative values. In this special election, your vote counts. I'm Ron Estes. I approve this message, and I need your help to drain this swamp on April 11th.
So it's a Trump guy, Estes, versus a Sanders guy, Thompson, in the first congressional election of the Trump era. It sounds exciting, right? Well, Neil Allen, who teaches political science at Wichita State University, says another race is attracting millions of dollars from all over the country and sucking the political oxygen, money that is, out of the Kansas 4th, where fundraising is measured in hundreds of thousands of dollars.
There's clearly going to be enough to run a solid campaign, but for both Republicans and especially Democrats, the fact that the Georgia 6th looks to be very competitive and that a collection occurs the first round a week after the Kansas 4th, that is drawing most of the national money.
The 4th district is tough for Democrats. In the last three congressional elections, Democratic challengers attracted only about 30% of the vote against Mike Pompeo. 30%. And Bob Beatty says it's unlikely Thompson is going to completely turn that around in the space of a few months.
Everybody would be just shocked if Thompson won. Personally, if it was within single digits here in Kansas, I'd say that's unbelievable.
But guess what? Late last week, the Kansas 4th District race suddenly popped up on Washington's radar. The National Republican Congressional Committee abruptly weighed in with a classic attack ad.
It gets worse. James Thompson supports abortion even if the parents don't like the gender of their baby. James
Thompson. Now, Beatty, for one, does not think that the GOP's last-minute $92,000 ad buy necessarily signals a big turn in the race. He says the idea may simply be to make sure that Estes's base takes the election seriously, because it's a pretty safe bet that Thompson's core people are. For Here and Now, I'm Frank Morris.
What's going on in Somalia? Yesterday, a suicide bomber dressed as a Somali army officer killed at least 7 soldiers at a military base in Mogadishu. The Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. Civilians are starving, as we'll hear. And President Trump recently signed a directive giving U.S. forces in Somalia more flexibility to carry out airstrikes and ground raids, which might put more civilians at risk. Abdi Samatar is a professor and the chair of the Department of Geography, Environment, and Society at the University of Minnesota. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you, Robin.
And first of all, give us some context. What was the combat situation before this action was taken? Remind us, you know, is al-Shabaab gaining more control in the country?
No, I don't think al-Shabaab is spreading into areas that it did not control before. In fact, the territory which al-Shabaab dominates has shrunk over the last few years. But they have been able to freely attack and firebomb some areas of the capital over the last few years. I don't think much has changed in terms of the strategic positions of the various forces, the AMISOM African Union force, their allies, including the United States, versus the Somali sort of militias that are called the Somali government's troops. So nothing has really changed on the ground.
Yeah, but we know that something that has changed in the country, or at least increased, is the terrible famine there, caused in large part by the drought. But one of the problems is that because of all the fighting in the country, we can't get water to the people. And we're going to take that up in a minute. But what are your thoughts about ramping up this U.S. involvement with these, you know, less restrictions at this point? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the U.S. Foreign policy towards Somalia has been a failure for a very long time. Both under Bush and under Obama, and now under the current president. It's a highly militaristic project, and the problem in the country is not military, but it's a political problem. And so there has not been a political program that will run simultaneously with whatever offensive forces are taken to al-Shabaab. So there's a political vacuum. That's problem number one. Number two, there has been very few resources going to build the Somali security forces. And as long as that's the case, al-Shabaab is going to be alive and well, regardless of how many drones we send to that part of the world. The drought, in my opinion, lack of rain is not a new issue in the country. What has been lacking is the absence of a government that's accountable to its people and that can monitor the weather and bring rescue to the people long before they begin to famish and die.
Somalia has a new president. He took office in February. Are you saying that he is ineffective or that maybe he can't overcome what came before him? What are you saying when you talk about politics?
Well, I mean, he has been here for a little over a month or so. And so that blame cannot be put on him yet. But the previous regime, which this government has inherited now, has been quite cruel, to put it bluntly. It didn't care about its people because everybody knew last year the rains failed and the year before the rain were not very good. And so everybody who was intelligent enough knew that things were going to be quite dire. They didn't do anything about this.
Yeah.
But I have not seen a programmatic blueprint by this new government that will tell us how we are going to wrestle military issues, but more importantly, resolve the political problems which are at the heart of the famine.
Well, President Trump campaigned on the notion of American first, not getting involved in other countries' conflicts. But here we have his administration, again, reducing constraints on forces in Somalia. Constraints that were put in place by the Obama administration and loosening constraints on how much the troops have to consider civilian casualties. Look, I'm sure there are people in Somalia saying whatever it takes to get rid of al-Shabaab. Your thoughts on loosening constraints on possibly having collateral damage with civilians?
I guess there was a study done quite a long time ago which valued the life of a third world person at $300,000 a year and the life of a European and American at $3 million. Mm. And so this seems to reflect that mentality that one human life is more precious than the other. But to come back to the question, Robin, the policies of the current president is double talk. If the government of the United States and those who, quote unquote, want to engage and help Somalia help itself, they have to put resources immediately, but in an organized, disciplined, strategic manner into rebuilding the Somalian security forces. Those are the only ones who can chase al-Shabaab to the sea. Secondly, and maybe even more importantly, the political project which the previous administration in the United States, Obama administration, and the current one is pursuing is a problem of that the politics is not our problem. And so, in fact, they endorse sectarian political projects in the country which keep dividing the country and its people into smaller and smaller fragments. So you put those two things together, I cannot foresee a way in which the current policy is going to succeed, and I can only see a way in which more and more civilians are going to be in harm's way without any accountability by the Somali government and the American government.
Abdi Samatar, professor and chair at the Department of Geography, Environment and Society at the University of Minnesota. Professor Abdi, thank you.
With pleasure, Robin.
To the drought and famine killing thousands in Somalia, the UN says some 185,000 children are at risk of dying from starvation without immediate help. Vice News correspondent Gianna Toboni just came back from Garoway in Somalia. Gianna, your reports are heartbreaking. You visited a little graveyard, most of the graves for children. They're buried and then covered with stones.
It was surreal. I could not believe, you know, it was just in the last few weeks from the time that we were there that gravesite had been built. And walking through that town, I think the most disturbing thing was seeing that graveyard, seeing that children were dying every few days from waterborne diseases, and then walking through the town and seeing the same well there with kids pouring water into buckets. The cycle is just continuing. And at this point, there isn't a solution because there is no clean water for them to drink.
The wells are causing cholera outbreaks. You met people who said that they used to dig down and find at least some water, but there's none there. But why can't water be brought in?
So this country hasn't had a functioning government in more than 20 years, 25, 26 years. So that infrastructure isn't there. Organizations have been doing a good job of getting aid to different places, but again, that disorganization exists. And so even if the resource is there, in many cases in a country like Somalia, it's just, you know, near impossible to have the coordination in order to get it where it needs to be.
Yeah. And so tell us more about the effect, what you're seeing.
We were driving through Puntland, which is a state in northern Somalia. Garoway is the city that we were in, and we drove for a few hours outside of Garoway just to sort of see, you know, where the worst of it is and what that looks like. Half of the country's population are herders, and so, you know, they're nomadic tribes and they live in huts. They pack up their huts and they move to find pastures for their animals. We were in an area where, again, for hours, all we could see were animal carcasses and abandoned huts. After, I would say, 2.5 hours, we came across a man who was walking by himself in the desert. And so we hopped out of the car and I walked over to him and asked what he was doing. And he said he had already lost 200 goats. He had lost camels. This also isn't just their food source. This is their livelihood. This is all of their assets are these animals. Because of the drought, the animals don't have fresh water. They don't have pastures. They have nothing to eat and drink, which is why they're dying. And I said, how long have you been walking? He had been walking for 5-6 hours in search of fresh water. His animals were too weak to go with him. His family, you know, at the same time wasn't getting the water and food that they needed. And I said, what concerns you most about seeing your animals die? And essentially what he said is he knows that he's next. You know, when the big animals start dying, and we heard this over and over while we were there, humans are next.
And the littlest ones first, the children first. You visited a clinic. What did you see there?
We went to two clinics. One was an IDP camp, which, you know, people walk for miles in order to get to these camps. you know, thinking that they're going to find clean water and food and antibiotics for their children, and even the camp didn't have, you know, enough resources to share with the families. When we went to the clinic in Garraway, just one of a few in the state, I think one of four in the entire state, we saw mothers and grandmothers and aunts with their babies and children who most of them had waterborne diseases, and many of them may not make it. And these parents don't know what to do. You know, they have this heartbreaking decision. Do they give their children contaminated water, knowing that they could, you know, contract a waterborne disease, or they allow their children to die of dehydration? It's just this decision that there's no good answer.
It must be heartbreaking. So how is the world community responding to this?
So the UN has asked for more than $800 million. About half of the country, 6.2 million people, are severely affected by this drought at this point. More than $300 million has been deposited, and they desperately need more at this point. You know, one thing that we heard from the UN there is that there is this compassion fatigue that I think happens when foreign governments have been funding a state for so many years and the state, you know, hasn't been able to rebuild itself. And so on some level, you know, I think Somalia is experiencing that.
Gianna Toboni, a correspondent for Vice News, will link you to her devastating reporting at hearandnow.org. Gianna, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Here and Now, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, and it'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. The survey will be very helpful to us, so thanks.
There was a moment in an interview last week with Russia expert Masha Gessen. Now, it's about 30 seconds long, part of an exchange I had with Gessen, who's a critic of Vladimir Putin and, in this moment, a critic of Donald Trump. Let's listen.
This is a man who lies all the time. So how do we actually figure out what to listen to and what to listen for?
And I just want to jump in to say that at NPR, we are not categorizing the president's words as lies, because the definition of the very definition of lies is intent. Somebody intended to tell an untruth, and we don't know what's going on in his head and whether or not he's being fed false information when he falsely says, for instance, that people boarded buses and went to New Hampshire to vote. So we are not categorizing them as lies, but they're certainly not
true. Am I allowed to?
Yes, you are. They're certainly not true. So that was last week, and many of you asked about that policy, which gives us a chance to clarify a couple things. First, there are many programs on public radio, but Here Now is a program actually produced with the news headquarters in Washington, which means we are subject to the NPR standards and practices. So let's bring in NPR standards and practices editor Mark Memmott. Mark, first, did I get the policy right about why NPR is not calling President Trump a liar?
Yes, you did. Our policy is to use the right words, to use words that convey the meaning that we feel needs to be conveyed, and words that won't get in the way of people understanding our story. So that's all applied in this case.
Okay. And was I right to bring it up? Catherine Olney is one of many listeners who objected to that. She says, we know NPR doesn't say Trump is a liar, but don't interrupt your guest. I felt if I didn't, it would be tacit agreement with Masha Gessen's words, which would then make be in opposition to NPR policy.
I think you were very right to bring it up. And I think it's always good to be transparent about these things, too, in any way we can to help listeners and readers of our websites understand what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Well, so talk a little bit more about why NPR has made this decision. Our ombudsman, Elizabeth Jensen, wrote a pretty lengthy article about it. She quotes Tom Rosenstiel, someone who thinks about journalism, and wrote an essay saying that journalists today need to keep their cool. It's something called tonal restraint. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, basically, we want people to listen to our stories, to read them when we write them, without making them stop and think that we're biased. I mean, to call someone a liar, that's a pretty heavy accusation. It has to be carefully weighed. And that's something else that plays through all the discussions that we have in the newsroom when we're deciding right. what words we should or shouldn't use.
Because the other thing you might be doing is taking the bait from anyone, and in this case an administration that has positioned the media as being the enemy and being in a fight with the administration.
Exactly. We are not an opposition party. We are not an enemy. We are there to present the facts that give people the information they need to be good, informed citizens.
Well, but as you've said, we have not banned the word lie, and there will be exceptions or might be exceptions.
Of course. I mean, if it can be determined that someone intentionally misled, that they repeated something over and over and over again despite knowing full well that it was false, then you're beginning to talk about being able to divine their intention, if you will.
Okay.
And that might be a point where we decide we need to pull out that word.
Mark Memmott, NPR Standards and Practices Editor. Just always good to kind of let listeners know what the standard and the practice is. Mark, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Corrine Daniel is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Corrine, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And you wanted us to hear from the Welsh artist Kate LeBon first. This is called Aside from Growing Old.
What's the
So I guess we'll start by noting this is not Joan Baez's long-lost cousin.
No, it is not. No, so she, as you mentioned, she's a Welsh singer. She sings in English and Welsh. And this is a follow-up to her last full-length album. But what I like about her is that she's kind of contemplative, effortless, and she said that her music doesn't require deep reading. But it's just kind of nice and light and always puts me in a good spirit. So that's just something I like about her, is that you can't really totally define her, but she's just got a nice air to her. So yeah, Kate LeBon, really enjoy her work.
Well, and Kate LeBon actually has been on the Here and Now DJ Sessions before, because Ann Litt, your colleague, brought her to our attention a few years back. What do you think of her new album?
I think it's great. It's definitely a reasonable continuation for what she's done in the past, and yeah, her other album, Mug Museum, was also really stellar. It's not too much of a jump from what she does, but she's also done some work on the side with Tim Presley of Drinks, and she's got like an interesting backing band now. They're called Banana, and they're like an instrumental band. They've released their own stuff. So while her own stuff is probably not too different, she's kind of dabbled in some other things, so maybe she'll take a leap in the next one.
All right, well, let's get to your next pick. This is Natalie Mehring, who calls herself Wise Blood. This is Seven Words.
Now I face tomorrow. In time we'll both be free from this ball and chain hanging on the things I want.
Another song that kind of takes you back to the 70s.
Yeah, I know. I feel like there's sort of a moment coming back here. Definitely some Carpenter-esque vibes with her. But what I like about her is that it's just so genuinely heartfelt, and sometimes it's pretty sad. I actually played this song, I think it was on Christmas, and I went on the air afterwards and I said, God, I'm so sorry for playing something so sad. And I got people calling me and telling me that it was the most, you know, beautiful thing that they had heard in so long. So I thought, you know, maybe she's kind of struck a nerve there. So I think the whole album is kind of like that. It's just very genuine and honest and sometimes sad, but also has a sense of humor about it, too.
Sometimes it feels good to hear a sad song on Christmas.
You know, it's a tough day for some people. Yeah. And yeah, I had no problem listening to it. I probably listened to it a little too much. So, you know, I have no problems with people enjoying a sad song now and again and again and again.
And let's talk about that name, Wise Blood, which is inspired by the 1952 novel Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor, about a young man grappling with his own questions about religion. Tell us more about Wise Blood.
Yeah, I think that makes sense with a lot of the work that she does as well, because some of it reflects on our current times and struggling as her with her identity. She has a track called Generation Y, but it's W-H-Y, where she kind of goes over people's love with their cell phones and kind of existing in this new age. And so I think that kind of resonates with her tone and definitely how she approaches songwriting lyrically.
Hmm. Well, you also wanted us to hear from the British rapper Simbi Ajikawo, who goes by Little Sims. This is Doorways and Trust Issues.
Hey, looking through this hallway, in a different place, some more I know a different ballgame. What is through the doorway, keep it pushing doorways, seeing different from where I've been told, been thinking all day. Oh, this is so smooth, coming from you nowhere. Anybody could say anything, I want to show you.
Well, what can you tell us about Little Sims?
What I like about her is that she's really young, but she has a strong sense of conviction and of herself. She's actually 22, and she's been rapping since she was 10. And, you know, I kind of admire her lyrics and how she's able to be very introspective and sort of wise at such a young age. She doesn't play on her sexuality at all. Like, she's very strong in herself and what she has to say and bring to the table. And I think it takes a lot of guts for a young person to do that. And so I really respect her for that. She also released the label. She created her own label and released the album under it. So I think, you know, at 22, you know, she has a lot going for her. So I'm just hoping that things keep going that way. So yeah, Little Sims.
Well, and one thing that I notice about this song is, you know, sometimes with British artists, it is hard to hear the British accent because they do such a good job at sounding like Americans. But in this, occasionally you can hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say she's definitively British, and she grew up in North London, and she references that in her work too. And yeah, it adds a different flavor to it as well. So I think it's a nice dimension.
Well, we have time for one more. This is from the Brooklyn group Prince Rama. This is Fantasy. Taken us from the 70s to the 80s, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Prince Rama, they do have definitely an 80s sound, but they've called themselves a now-age psych dance pop band.
Hmm.
So it just encompasses a lot more than the 80s tone that they give off, because there's a lot of visual components to the work that they do, and their shows are unexpected. The makeup that they put on is really fantastic. And yeah, so it's kind of a whole package that calls on some 80s elements, but yeah, they also have a mantra for their now age philosophy. I think you can check it out online. It's like nowage.org.
Hmm. And Prince Rama is made up of two sisters, by the way, Taraka and Nime Larson. Tell us more about them.
Yeah, so they actually have been doing this, I think, for about 10 years. Their dad was an artist as well, and I think really encouraged them to take their own path, and they definitely did that with this band. So they just tour and, I don't know, are inspired by the visual art and also the manifestos that they create. So it's not just the band. I think it's a lot of a lifestyle as well. But you kind of have to see them visually to really get the whole package.
So since this is your first time with us on the Here and Now DJ sessions, and after hearing those four picks from you, what is your genre? Or would you just say, like, eclectic or something like that?
I think I like things that are meaningful and speak to people. I think sonically, I'm okay with any instrument. It's not that a certain sound necessarily calls me. I think if something is, you know, like Prince Rama is just silly and fun and, you know, it's totally on one side of the spectrum. Wise Blood can totally go on the other side. Little Sims as well. I think you've got to have range in what you enjoy in your art. And I don't know. I can't pinpoint it. It might be a cop-out to say eclectic, but I think maybe genuine is the word that resonates with me the most. And obviously that's subjective to everyone, but for me that's what matters.
That's Karine Daniel, who is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, where, by the way, the morning show is called Morning Becomes Eclectic. So, eclectic, a big word at KCRW. Karine, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. This was great.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Within 48 hours of those U.S. strikes on a Syrian airfield last week, President Trump sent a short letter to Congress justifying the attacks as required under the War Powers Resolution of 1973. He cited U.S. intelligence that Syrian forces were responsible for the chemical weapons attack on their own citizens that preceded his missile attack, and he said he acted in the vital national security and foreign policy interests of the U.S. Well, there are questions about whether or not the chemical attack, as horrific as it was, did threaten U.S. security, and whether the president should have asked Congress before his strike. Noor Ben-Sahel is a military analyst and distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University. Noor, start with the War Powers Resolution I mentioned, 1973. What does it say about when a president can order any kind of military action?
Well, it requires presidents to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking any military action. And it also forbids forces from staying any longer than 60 days in a military campaign without an authorization for the use of military force or an explicit declaration of war.
So there are requirements. If President Trump wants to continue strikes on Syria, he has to do what within 60 days?
Well, technically, he has to notify Congress that he intends to do so, and Congress needs to approve that with a new authorization for the use of military force. In practice, no president has ever followed what the War Powers Act suggests, Republican or Democrat. The position of the presidency has always been that the War Powers Act is unconstitutional because it impinges on the rights of the commander-in-chief as set out in the Constitution.
Well, hold on there, because it sounds like you're saying it's become part of the office that a president, no matter which party, disagrees with this having to make this request. But we've had presidents in just very recent history ask for these authorizations. President Bush received two, one for Afghanistan after 9/11, another in 2002 ahead of the invasion of Iraq.
That's right. And President Bush and President Obama both argued that the one that was adopted after September 11th applied for terrorist attacks more broadly. It wasn't just about Afghanistan. It was about strikes against al-Qaeda. And both presidents maintained that even now the strikes against ISIS, for example, are descendants of al-Qaeda and therefore covered by the September 11th authorization of the use of military force. What's different about this strike is that it was at a Syrian regime target, which is obviously not a terrorist center, and thus the question of whether it's authorized comes up again.
Yeah, because it's not covered by the two existing authorizations of military force, unless that government is harboring terrorists, and of course Syria is fighting ISIS. Look, explain too that President Obama did try to get a three-year authorization of force in Syria, but there were liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans who didn't want that. Other Republicans did want to give it to him. In fact, they wanted him to sign one seeking more congressional approval than Donald Trump just sought.
That's right. And what President Obama wanted from Congress was essentially more buy-in for the strikes that he was taking. Very often, the War Powers Act has been used for members of Congress to criticize the president politically without getting involved and without actually then taking the next step in authorizing force. So President Obama did ask Congress for a new authorization, particularly for the strikes on ISIS when they moved inside Syria, although he also maintained at the same time that he was asking for one, that he didn't actually need one because it was still covered under the 9/11 one. Congress, as you might imagine, didn't find this particularly compelling, and there's been a lot of resistance in Congress to voting on any new authorization for military force after what was seen as a very politically risky move to vote on the Iraq War. Because that war was so unpopular, members of Congress who voted for it found that that had become a political liability, and there's been very strong reluctance in Congress to actually go on the record about whether they support the use of force or not.
So it's an authorization that's shaky on both sides.
Right. President Obama asked for one while maintaining he didn't need one, and Congress said that he needed one but didn't actually vote on one when Obama proposed the language.
Right. And just to be clear, in President Trump's case, we understand presidents are allowed a little bit of leeway. The Constitution requires that presidents ask Congress for authorization for war, but an occasional strike, and if this is a one-off, it would be that, they kind of get that wiggle room.
That's right. And that is true within the War Powers Act. But again, it's always interesting that every president, when they have notified Congress, and they've done that over 120 times since the War Powers Act was adopted in 1973, they never say that they are doing it in line with the legal requirement of the War Powers Act. They use the word pursuant to it, which may sound like a small difference, but legally, it's a very big difference. No president has acknowledged that they are bound by the War Powers Act. And the courts have declined to rule on this whenever it's come before them, saying that this is a political matter, not a judicial matter for them to resolve.
Fascinating. Nora Ben-Sahel, military analyst at American University, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.